At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, what on earth is going on with the Golden Globes and Tom Cruise? We go to Hollywood with our man, Tim Gray of Variety, to get the skinny. Mark Ryle on the week's new releases, which deal with crimes of the past and sins in space. Plus, Mr. Sunshine himself, Ian Dempsey, on his favourite movie. I'm open on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the News Talk app powered by Go Loud, and it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk. Good weekend to you all. Hope you're doing well. I felt some normality returning to my life this week. My son went to football training. I ran outdoors with a friend, as in actually running. I know, it's quite a vision for you. I met my mother outside for lunch in Stephen's Green. So I hope you're finding some normality returning to your lives, albeit in a safe fashion. Now, let's get to movies and TV. And the big TV event of the week, I think, is this.
Where do they go? The ones that run away and never return.
There's nothing here but suffering. Pain and suffering. It is time to go.
The girl in that bulletin is wanted for the murder of a child.
Man lost my mom. Then me. Ain't no way he ever given up on finding me.
Now, that's a clip from The Underground Railroad, which is on Amazon as of Friday, the 14th of May. You may have read a bit about this. It's based on the novel by Colson Whitehead, inspired by a real-life Underground Railroad, which was basically a route of safe houses and anti-slavery activists who guided escaped slaves to safety. Now, in the novel and the subsequent TV series, they fictionalized the eponymous railroad as a literal train system that was underground where escaped slaves would get on trains. So it's kind of a alternative history, but similar history take on this. And in the TV version of it, which, as I say, is on Amazon from Friday, it kind of centers on one slave in particular, Cora Randall, played by Tuso Madubi, a newcomer of an actress who's a slave in a Georgian plantation. And her mother, this character, was the only slave to ever have escaped and evaded capture before. So it's ostensibly about her and lots of other people, of course. It's directed by Barry Jenkins, the man who gave us Moonlight, If Beale Street Could Talk. And, you know, people talk about prestige TV. This is certainly that. This feels like cinema on the TV. It really does. Now, I'm only a couple of episodes in, so, you know, I can't tell you definitively that this is great, but based on the first couple of episodes, it certainly is so far. It's heavy going, particularly in the first episode, which featured horrific, I guess, torture of slaves, included whipping, someone in essence being burnt alive. Tough going. There was chinks of light, a significant amount of light in the next episode, but it's really good. It looks great. It's sumptuous. It looks dark at times when they're underground. The story moves from a different location every week to parts of the antebellum South. And so far, it's really, really good. Joel Edgerton plays, I guess you'd call him, a slave hunter who's on Cora's case and who's obsessed with capturing her, having failed to capture her mother, the woman who previously escaped. So I'm really looking forward to get further stuck into this because it bodes really well. It's, as I say in the first episode, it was tough going, but it's meaty television and compelling. And I can't wait to watch the rest of it. So let me know. It's been out since Friday, depending on when you're listening to this show. That's today or yesterday or whenever, if you're listening on the podcast. But it's been out since Friday on Amazon Prime. So you need Amazon to watch it. So if you might have, let me know what you're making of it so far. That's The Underground Railroad by the great Barry Jenkins, based on a novel which I haven't read, by Colson Whitehead, which I know people rave about as well. Now, just quickly, in TV, if you're a regular listener to News Talk, you'll know that I present a series on Pat Kenny every couple of weeks called Boxed, where I take a look back at some classic television. And this week I did Family by Roddy Doyle. So I rewatched the entire thing. Now, it's only four episodes, so it wasn't that much out of my life. Plus, it was wonderful to rewatch it again to remind myself and ourselves just what a scintillating piece of television that was. If you heard me talking about it on Pat Kenny, forgive me for briefly repeating myself, but this was a show co-produced with RT and the BBC. Tellingly, it came out, I think, 4 days after Riverdance had been broadcast at the Eurovision in 1994, and it tells the story of a working class family in Dublin with Charlo Spencer as the pretty rotten head, albeit at times charismatic, head of this family. Opposite is his long-suffering, brilliantly played wife Paula by Ger Ryan, and his two children, John Paul and Nicola. It is wonderful, dark TV, brilliantly acted, ahead of its time in the way it deals with story. There's four episodes, each told from a different point of view of one of the characters. There's kind of fast cutting. At the time, and I was talking to Pat Kenny about this, it was incendiary in terms of the impact it had on Irish life. I remember I was doing my Leaving Cert at the time, and it was debated long and hard, people saying Roddy Doyle was poorly representing working class people and poorly representing Irish families. I think he's shown to be on the side of the angels now. And 27 years later, we can actually say this was just a wonderful piece of television. So I was watching that again this week. It's all on YouTube. You can legally watch it on YouTube. I watched it all on DVD. I put it into the machine and pressed play. I hadn't done that in a long time. Nice feeling, I have to say, because I knew nothing was going to go wrong with it. My Wi-Fi couldn't go. My Wi-Fi could have gone down. It goes down all the time. But that wouldn't have affected the DVD. It was nice having the tangible copy of it. Anyway, it is available on YouTube. You can watch it all in its entirety. Family by Roddy Doyle, directed by Michael Winterbottom. It is remarkable television. Let me know if you might have watched it recently or even in 1994 when it came out, or if you've watched The Underground Railroad. John_Fardy, or you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. Now, my next guest previously told me that Hollywood is in a constant state of chaos. Well, that appears to be more true than ever this week. In case you haven't heard, the Golden Globes won't be taking place next year. And Tom Cruise, at the start of the week, handed back his previous awards. It seems that the center of all this is the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, who in essence run the Golden Globes, and their serious lack of diversity, and perhaps a bit worse than that. I'm delighted to be joined now by the one man who can help me put some shape on this, and that is the guy we go to in Hollywood, Tim Gray of Variety. Tim, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
I'm good. All the better for chatting to you. So, Tim, you know, when I first heard this, you know, Tom Cruise giving back his awards, I thought, you know, it's another strange thing in the life of Tom Cruise's very strange life thus far. I read a little more about it. And, you know, the Hollywood Foreign Press, I think, certainly have a case to answer for. Would you just give us some sense, as best you can, of what the problem is, why people are so annoyed with them?
Well, the Hollywood Foreign Press is basically 86 reporters based in Los Angeles or Southern California who cover the entertainment industry. And it's been around since 1943. You know, they got together to try and help each other get coverage. But as the Golden Globes in the 1990s got to be more and more popular, the Hollywood Foreign Press gained more power. And so they started dictating terms on how the studios should handle their films. Here's what we're going to do. And the studios played along. But then the LA Times wrote a story criticizing the HFPA about, you know, how strange some of their choices are, and basically implying that there's a little bit of corruption there. That didn't get a big reaction, but then the next day, the LA Times wrote a story saying, and out of 86 people, there's not a single Black person in there. And that made people crazy. And so that really started all this. You know, the kind of acceptable narrative these days is that the Hollywood Foreign Press is a bunch of bigots. But in truth, it's a story about money and power, which, you know, certainly in Hollywood, that those are the two factors behind everything. But a lot of people are trying to take down the organization because of their own motives, which is either money or power.
And in terms of how they nominate people for the Golden Globes, is the accusation or the supposition that they are nominating people because it's in their vested interest if certain movies or actors win?
Well, you know, I always think awards are kind of a hard gauge of things, because it's like, you know, if you say to them that was kind of a weird choice, it's like, yeah, I liked that movie. So, you know, there's no kind of defense against that. But yeah, they've been under pressure for a long time. But, you know, the NBC, which carries the Golden Globes in America, and it sells it to other stations around the world, a few years ago, paid like $60 million a year to air the Golden Globes. And at the time, everybody kind of thought they were overpaying. But now with COVID, with the ratings falling, NBC really wants to renegotiate and get a lower price there. So, you know, I don't know that NBC is behind all the negative press, but I think they're certainly happy about it, because it takes the HFPA down a peg and it opens the door to renegotiate. NBC recently said, we're not going to carry the show next year. That may be true, or it may be a bargaining tactic. I don't know.
So, Tim, am I sensing from you that you're not really sure if this has anything to do with diversity, and that really it's just, as you say, about money and power, and that people aren't actually that bothered about the lack of diversity?
Well, I think it's a little bit human nature, and it's a little bit Hollywood. There's a lot of hypocrisy going on, because you know, leading the charge against the HFPA are the publicists. Now, you know, every film or every TV show has a publicist from the studio or from the network, but there are also personal publicists. So if you take like the Avengers movies, you know, that's from Disney Marvel. So they have several publicists on that. But there's also a personal publicist for Robert Downey Jr. Chris Evans has his own, all that. And they like to be in charge of dictating the terms, but the HFPA is saying, oh, no, here's how we're going to do it. We're going to have a special screening for us of every film of yours. We're going to have your people come to us, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, and they dictated the terms, and that makes the publicist crazy. So, you know, the charge of the racism, you know, the publicists were like, this is outrageous, you have to change, and all that kind of stuff. But the truth of it is, those publicists are overwhelmingly Caucasian. I mean, I think that, you know, out of 100 people who signed this form against the HFPA, I think there's just a handful of Black people there. So they're not exactly above it all. But I keep thinking, wait a minute, you've been dealing with these people for 5, 10, 15 years, and you never noticed that there wasn't a Black person before? But it's like, this is an opportunity to kind of jump on the bandwagon, to show their own virtue. And it's like, oh, no, we will not back down. This is unacceptable what they're doing. And I think the publicists, for one thing, they want to take the focus away from their lack of diversity. And they also want to take down a little bit of the HFPA's power.
Okay, wow. And there was another incident, though. A former president of it, Philip Burke, had sent an email saying that Black Lives Matter was a racist hate movement. I presume that certainly didn't help.
No, well, Philip Burke, I mean, I have to be careful here, but I've known him for a long time, and he's always been a loose cannon. I mean, I can think of at least four incidents in the last 10 years when he embarrassed the HFPA. And I think the HFPA's biggest problem, I mean, aside from not having a Black person, is I think they're very passive. You know, and with Philip Burke, after all of these embarrassments, they would just kind of let it go and reprimand him gently. But, you know, it's, you know, that old thing, one bad apple spoils the whole bunch. And I think out of 86 people, there are a handful of HFPA members who are really embarrassing. And so that they give it a bad name. But also the HFPA, they were a little passive, because when Oscars So White started in 2015, basically attacking the Academy, which hands out the Oscars, saying, you know, this is unacceptable, there's not a lot of Black people, you would think that the HFPA people would look around and say, you know what, maybe we ought to get some Black members in here. And they didn't. And so this was 6 years ago. So it's like, what were you guys thinking? Did you not realize that you were going to be held accountable for this one day? And so they are being held accountable. But I think that's only one of the issues involved here.
Yeah. And then what do you make then of Tom Cruise's take in all this? And, you know, if he is doing it for the reasons we've been talking about diversity, one would have to say that's very noble. But I can't help feeling that a lot of people have a suspicion about his motives. And I'm not even sure why, but there is a sense that, I may be wrong here. What do you think? Is it bandwagonism on his part? I mean, is he committed to the cause of greater diversity in Hollywood?
I mean, I don't know. One always tries to read between the lines with all of these stories. And, you know, Scarlett Johansson said, you know, I'm not going to go to their press conferences anymore, because, again, the HFPA would have their own press conference. You know, most movies would have press from, you know, multiple other organizations, but the HFPA had their own. She said, you know, the questions were so sexist and invasive that I'm not going to do it anymore. And I think I think she's probably right. I think one or two people asked really rude questions. So with Tom Cruise, I don't know if he has an experience. I think people are a little suspicious of him ever since he jumped up and down on Oprah's couch.
Yes.
You know, and it's like, wait, what is this guy up to? He might be sincere. You know, I think that's quite possible. But you know, he wanted to make a statement. I'm suspicious of some of the other people who are virtue signaling, you know, like the publicist saying, oh my God, we're above all this. But with Tom Cruise, I think, I don't know what his motivation is. I think it's possible he's sincere. Yeah. But again, I think the public is a little leery of his methods.
Yes, his sincerity comes with a little baggage, let's say. Yeah. And then just finally then, Tim, I mean, I was thinking about this. You know, I've talked to you about the Golden Globes over the years, but I was wondering, would anyone miss it if it never came back? And I'm fascinated by it, but I'm in that space. Would it matter much to the machine of Hollywood? I mean, maybe it would. Maybe it's like you're saying, it's about money and power. But what do you think about that?
Well, I think the studios like the Golden Globes, studios and the networks, because they happen in January, and this is a way for to publicize what they're doing. So it's like when you see a nominee or a presenter, you know, they're putting in plugs for their upcoming work. So it's in terms of marketing, it's been useful, and NBC would use the time to also promote its upcoming TV shows. So it is useful. But I think if the Golden Globes went away, they would find some other substitute to get in that. And there are other organizations, again, who want to take down the HFPA because they want their organization to have that high profile and the big money from the networks. So I think Hollywood does need something, you know, in terms of promotion. But, you know, whether it's the Golden Globes or not, I don't know. I think I do think NBC could renegotiate with the Globes at a much lower price. And I think they might like that. But on the other hand, they might move on and just say, okay, we don't need you, your organization. We've got other organizations lining up here.
Yeah. Well, Tim, it's a grim picture you paint of money and power being what it's all about, as opposed to anything more virtuous, or certainly that seems to be the main part of what this is all about. But as always, thank you for kind of distilling it down and giving us the view from Hollywood. We really appreciate it.
Well, I'm always happy to talk to you. But yeah, it is one of those cases, you know, because in Hollywood, you always want a real clear villain and you want a real clear hero. I'm not sure there's a lot of heroes in this story. It's you know, it's partly about Hollywood, it's partly about human nature, is that people are out for their self-interest. And it's, it's a very troubling development, what's going on here. I'm curious to see what's going to happen. So we'll keep talking.
We certainly shall. I would appreciate that very much. Thanks a lot, Tim.
Okay, thank you.
Tim Gray there of Variety, talking to me about the business of the Golden Globes and Tom Cruise giving back his statues, his awards, and I suppose in particular talking about the Hollywood Foreign Press Association. And Tim's take to me is fascinating in that the whole issue of diversity, not that it's a smokescreen, but what people are really concerned about in Hollywood is money and power, and that the Hollywood Foreign Press have too much power. That's Tim's take on it. I don't know. It's certainly an interesting view, though. Up next, Mark Ryle on the week's new releases.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talk's TV and movie show. It's that stage of the week where we look at the week's new releases. This week we're looking at, I think, a pretty interesting movie called Oxygen, which was released on Netflix on Wednesday, and also a movie coming to Sky Atlantic this Friday, to Sky Cinema, I should say, this Friday, the 14th of May, The Secrets We Keep. More of that in a minute. I'm joined now by Mark Ryle, a resident critic who has stolen himself away from his fourth organized trip to Penny's this week to be with us tonight. Hello, Mark. How are you?
Hi, John. I'm good.
Good. You got that boob tube you needed so badly.
I don't need any more boob tubes. I've got more than I'll ever use.
Okay, so you're just window shopping mostly in Penny's. Anyway, to the matters at hand. So let's start with Oxygen, an interesting movie, as I said, which is on Netflix from Wednesday of this week. What's going on here?
Yeah, Oxygen, it's a high concept, low key sci-fi. The elevator pitch would be very much along the lines of woman wakes up in a box with no memory of how she got there. And Melanie Laurent is the woman in the box. She plays Liz, who at, I suppose, an unspecified time in the future, wakes up in a cryogenic tube, and she can't remember how she got there or why she is there in the tube. And then this artificial intelligence voiced by Matthew Almerich informs her that her oxygen levels are running out. So she needs to piece together her memories and get out of the tube before her oxygen runs out, which is happening at a fast rate.
It certainly is. And as you say, woman in box, the box being a cryogenic chamber. And, you know, we don't want to give spoilers or anything, but it's fair to say that this is, you know, kind of touch of horror, touch of sci-fi as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I said last week that I never want to see another film during lockdown movie. But to be fair, now I think Oxygen is a very good example of how to do that kind of thing right. The story takes advantage of the difficulties of shooting a movie under COVID safeguards and guidelines, and it makes a virtue of them. Because barring a couple of flashbacks, Melanie Laurent carries the entire movie by herself. She's the sole focus for the entire runtime. And I suppose the film either lives or dies on her shoulders. And I'm happy to say that she is very good. And so is Christy LeBlanc's script. It's no mean feat to pull off something like this, to hold our attention for an hour and 40 minutes in a box without any change of pace at all.
Yeah, no, that's very well said. Because interestingly enough, you know, we've discussed this before, but my wife was often watches these movies with me, and she said 2 minutes in, I can't watch this. This is too claustrophobic. But then when it went on, I mean, it was claustrophobic because how could it not be? But not, it wasn't claustrophobic storytelling. You know what I mean? In that you felt it was going places despite the fact that the character wasn't really going anywhere.
Exactly. Yeah. Well said.
There's a movie, thank you.
There's a Ryan Reynolds movie called Buried from 2010, I think it was, that kind of does the same thing. It's a hard thing to pull off, you know. The cinematographer, Maxime Alexandre, he has to work really, really hard to keep things interesting because he's got a really limited visual palette and he's got very few options. Mm. And the director, Alexandre Aja, he's not really known for sci-fi. He's probably best known for his work in the horror genre. And we talked about he had an alligator movie called Crawl.
Yeah.
Back in 2019 that we talked about here. And what I remember about Crawl is that it had an acute awareness of space, and Alexandre Aja, he knows where to place the camera to create this maximum tension. And that is really, really apparent here as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well said on your part. And we just go back to Melanie Laurent. She, like, it obviously rests and dies on her. So I just want to, you know, second what you were saying there, to carry off I think it was not far off 2-hour movie where it's just her. There's one or two flashbacks, but really there's very little acting going on apart from her, is some feat. So she needs to be applauded for that.
It is. It's tremendous. Yeah, yeah. There are certain sections where it begins to kind of resemble somebody watching somebody trying to fix their hard drive by running Microsoft Windows diagnostics. And I think the narrative plausibility gets stretched the closer it gets to the ending. But I think by that stage, you've either bought into this or you haven't. And I think if you're a fan of Black Mirror, then I think you'll probably get a lot out of this one.
Yeah, that's I'm going to give you another well said for that. That's 2-1 to you. But what I liked about it as well was that, you know, and it's not a spoiler, but parts of how she got there are slowly revealed.
Yeah.
So that spices it up a bit and mixes up. So it's not just a series of her, as you say, trying to figure out Matt's problems or whatever, you know. Now, it is in French, but that was of absolutely no consequence in a way. And you think that might be because it's one actress, but because it's such a, in a weird kind of way, a visual concept as well, being trapped in a box, that was not of any consequence whatsoever, you know?
Absolutely not. No, it really does hold your interest, I think.
Yeah. Of course, I watched it without subtitles, you know? Suit the law. No, I'm joking, of course. I was actually thinking that, how little French I know, despite the fact that I did it for 6 years in school. I kept waiting for someone to say, je voudrais un jambon, but it never happened, you know? I'm starting to sound like Brendan O'Carroll here. Listen, I'm sensing you enjoyed...
Yeah, let's not do that.
I'm sensing you enjoyed this a good bit then.
I did. No, it's great, you know? It's really a cut above the usual straight to Netflix stuff, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think now if we go back over, certainly this year, Netflix movies are on an upward. You haven't been a fan traditionally, but you know, things like The Dig, White Tiger, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. I mean, you've been fans of these over the last.
I have. I'm not sure the actual ratio of movies that they release, but I'm sure that it's still not stacked in favor of the good ones.
Okay. So what are you going to say stars-wise for Oxygen?
I'm going to give it a 3.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I think I'll give it a 3 as well. Maybe even a 3.5 because I did enjoy it. So that's Oxygen on Netflix from this Wednesday gone, the 12th of May. I'm not sure if you're meant to say Oxygen in French, which is like Oxygen or something like that.
Go for it.
Yeah, Oxygen. So that is 3 stars. And I'm going to give it 3.5 for Oxygen on Netflix. I can't really play a clip because it'll be in French. And that really won't make any sense. A movie in French about a woman in a cryogenic chamber who doesn't go anywhere. That sounds really dull. It isn't. It's actually a pretty good movie, as we've been saying. So on Sky Cinema from this Friday, the 14th of May, is The Secrets We Keep with Noomi Rapace. And Chris Messini's in it as well. Mark, what's this one about?
This is set in 1950s small town America, and Noomi Rapace and Chris Messina are Maya and Lewis. During the war, he was a doctor, and she is a Romanian immigrant whose entire family was murdered by the Nazis when they escaped a prison camp in Bucharest. And in the years following the war, they have both built a good life for themselves. But then Maya spots a new face in town, and she becomes convinced that this is a monster from her past who is lying about his true identity. So she takes matters into her own hands.
Yes, indeed she does. And what I liked about we'll get into the movie in a minute, but the thing she recognized, or she thinks she recognizes, about the guy from the past is the way he walks.
I thought it was the way he whistles for his dog, no?
I thought it was the way he walks. Maybe it was a combination of the two, but I remember being intrigued by the fact that she saw him on the street and was just taken with his gait and his demeanor, that he reminded her possibly of someone. What did you think of this?
It's an interesting premise. It's a very good-looking movie. I think the 1950s are a gift for costume designers and production designers.
Yeah,
and it's a very.
I'm going to give you another well said for that.
it's a really stylish, and it looks gorgeous, but it does have this feeling that it's just all surface, and it never really goes any deeper than that. It's a solid thriller, but it kind of lacks the significant emotional heft that you need to make sure that something is going to stay with you when it's finished. I kind of forgot this as I was done with it. And there's nothing particularly wrong with The Secrets We Keep. And there's nothing really that's glaringly out of place or objectionable. But at the same time, there's no part of it that's especially noteworthy either. And I'm not even going to say that that's a shame, because it's good enough, and it is what it is. And there's really nothing wrong with that.
I think I'm going along with you. I mean, I was going to say pleasant is the wrong word, but it held my interest the whole way through, but then was kind of forgettable afterwards. But, you know, it's not going to live long in the memory. That said, two things about it. One, less positive, is that I did feel it was almost, you know, and maybe this is just someone who watches a lot of movies, but a mishmash of a lot of things, or I'd seen aspects of it before, you know, like Apt Pupil and those movies about recognizing someone from your past. And often they have to do with kind of war crimes and stuff. On the other hand, which I thought was better, was I did think Noemi Rapace, she had a real subtlety to it. And the bit that really stood out for me at times was that there is this whole thing. Is she remembering this correctly? Is she too troubled by what's happened to her to be a reliable narrator? Is she that, you know, old trope of the, you know, unreliable narrator, you know? So I liked that about it. I thought she was the strongest thing in it.
It didn't really go deep enough with the unreliable narrator stuff, for me. I think, yeah, we have to talk about Polanski's Death and the Maiden, really, don't we? Because it kind of, Sigourney Weaver and Ben Kingsley are more or less playing out the exact same plot as Rapace and Kinnaman. Joel Kinnaman is the maybe Nazi. Mm. I think the problem isn't that the director Yuval Adler lifted his inspiration from Death and the Maiden. I think it's more that The Secrets We Keep doesn't take that inspiration and do anything fresh or interesting with it. That was my big problem with it. In terms of, you know, Rapace, she is, incidentally, by the way, she was attached to play the Melanie Laurent part in Oxygen, and
really,
yeah, she was replaced in a coincidence. I think, you know, everybody is fine. Rapace and Kinnaman, they're good enough. I think Chris Messina probably has to put more work in, because for me, I got the impression that his character was kind of, as he's written, is ill-defined, and his motivation was a bit muddled and ropey.
Yeah, I go along with that.
There's a couple of unintentionally funny scenes due to the fact that they have a five-year-old running around, and Chris Messina keeps on having to say stuff like, oh, you know, go and play in your room while there's stuff happening in the basement, you know.
Yeah, kids get in the way of Nazi hunting, I think.
They really do, don't they? Yeah. Do you want to have a sleepover? Okay, go on. It's fine, I think, is the best I can say about it.
Yeah, no, I think I go along with you entirely. And my wife did watch this one, and she said pretty much the same thing as you said, a lot more articulately, obviously.
Obviously, you know. Yeah.
So what would you say stars-wise?
I'm going to give it a 3.
I think I'll give it a 3 as well, for all the reasons we just outlined. That is The Secrets We Keep, available on Sky Cinema from Friday the 14th of May. Me and Mark Ryle are giving it 3 stars in the battle, or the competition of the well-saids. Mark outdid me 3-1. Thank you, Mark, a worthy winner.
Thanks, John.
Up next, Ian Dempsey on his favourite movie.
Screen Time on News Talk.
Now you're listening to Screen Time, News Talks TV and Movie Show. It's that stage of the week where we talk to someone well-known about their favourite movie. I'm delighted and indeed chuffed to be joined now, well, by someone I've been listening to, not to age him, but it seems like all my life. Ian Dempsey, how are you?
John, how are you? Pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for asking me to come on here.
My pleasure.
I'm not a massive movie buff. My wife is more into movies, but I was looking through a list, and it took me a while to actually come up with the one that I wanted to choose for this. So will I tell you what it is now, or
why not? Yes, you're going into straight DJ mode there. I don't even have to ask you anything. It's great.
This is my big problem. I do this all the time. Somebody comes on and attempts to interview me, and I suddenly take it over and start asking them questions. So
I'll try not
to do that, John. Okay.
I appreciate that. It's like as Tommy Tiernan said with Ray Darcy, it's like John the Baptist trying to lecture Jesus. But all I was going to say to you was, you say, you know, you're not that much of a movie buff, and we'll get to this later, but you have interviewed a lot of serious stars. So you've seen a fair amount of movies over the years, it's fair to say, right? Just to clarify that.
That's true. No, I have seen a few. And recently now I've seen, for example, like I like a lot of documentaries. There's a very good one about Motown called Hitsville, which I would recommend.
Oh, yes, yes.
That's really good. Berry Gordy Jr. and Smokey Robinson. The absolute bromance going on there. The other one is a totally mad, I don't know whether you've seen it, Unhinged with Russell Crowe, which is on, you can stream it now. And it's just about a guy who somebody in traffic, a woman in traffic, doesn't let him in or says something to him that he just, you know, it's like anything that could happen to you or I in traffic, say in Dublin or whatever. And he just goes completely mad, and he just spends the rest of the movie killing people that she knows. And it's unbelievable. It's real kind of, I'd say B, C, D, E, F movie maybe, but he's great and it's fantastic. And one of the ones I was going to go for was actually a film, I don't know whether you remember it, you're probably far too young to remember it. Roy Scheider was in it, and it's called All That Jazz.
Yeah.
About Bob Fosse. It's kind of based on the life of Bob Fosse, the choreographer. Yeah. But I didn't think anybody would have known it. So I've gone for Dublin-based Commitments. The Commitments. Oh, what a joyous movie. Brilliant.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I'm assuming no one in Ireland nearly hasn't seen this, right? But why is that? Why do you, today, is that your favorite film or the movie you wanted to go for?
I just think that there is, I mean, I've looked at it again because I knew I was going to be coming on and talking to you. And we actually bought it during lockdown. Every weekend we were trying to find something to do. We were, you know, buying dartboards and swing balls and all this kind of stuff. One day I got the idea of doing a click and collect and buy the Barrytown trilogy. So I've got The Van, Snapper and The Commitments. And I just watched it again. And there's so many great moments in it. And Dublin looks both awful and brilliant at the same time, and there's so much joy, and there's so many characters in it and some great moments, and Alan Parker obviously took it all, and he really kind of I think he just depicted Dublin as this magical place that everybody would like to come and visit, and I think it's probably resulted in a lot of people visiting and knowing that there's a bit of fun to be had, there's lots of music and there's plenty of soul.
Yeah. And would you just remind listeners, like briefly in a few lines, for the, you know, the mere mortals who haven't seen it, but what exactly is it about? It's about a band, but it's about a band
from Dublin's north side, and this guy called Jimmy Rabbit is a kind of a bit of a wheeler dealer, and he's also gone into band management, and he decides to put this band together. They're going to do soul, and it's going to be Dublin soul, and they get the band together and the band forms, and they do kind of half well, and then they do better and better, and then of course they start having their differences, and then they start beating the crap out of each other, and then they're promised all kinds of things and it never happens, and it's just brilliant all the way through. And I suppose it's kind of everybody's dream. If you don't want to be a Premier League footballer, you want to be in a band, and you want to be, you know, you want to be famous, basically, you know. So that's about it. But it's brilliantly done, and the cast. I mean, like I keep thinking about the cast and saying, where are all these people now? Like Andrew Strong playing Deco, the lead singer, who everybody hated in, you know, in the band, but a brilliant lead singer, and what a voice as well.
Yeah.
I know he brought a few albums out afterwards, and Robert Arkins, who did the kind of the opening song, Treat Her Right, when the whole thing starts off. And another great artist. And of course, you've got Glenn Hansard then, from the Frames. And, you know, this Phelim Drew and Imelda Quirk, well, not Imelda Quirk, Angeline Ball and Maria Doyle Kennedy. And, you know, and Brona Gallagher. Fantastic cast. And a lot of them kind of unknown at the time, but world famous now.
Yeah. And, you know, despite what you said, sir, I'm not as young as you might think. It's the moisturizer I've been using.
But that's what it is.
I remember when it came out, and it was 91, I think.
That's right.
And there was just a sense, wow, this is a cool movie about Dublin, because, you know, no disrespect to Glen Rowe, or, but we had a pretty limited kind of TV and movie database of where Ireland looked cool or funky or whatever. Like, you probably remember, you were, I guess you were in radio at that stage, you're getting near it anyway. Like, there was a sense of, this is deadly, and we kind of look and sound great in it.
Oh yeah, brilliant. And I mean, we were very proud of it as well, and proud of the fact that when it went to America, that they had to provide a kind of a dictionary for the people going along to see it, to explain what some of the words meant and all that. And actually, my son, who I think you have met on occasion, Shane, who's now 31 or something like that, that came out just after he was born in 1990, and it came out in 91. And then by the time it went to kind of video or DVD, it would have been about 92, 93. But I'm proud to say that that's where he learned his choice bad language, because I couldn't believe it. This little 2.5-year-old going around saying F this and F that and whatever, you know, but he got it from The Commitments, and brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And it was something that everybody was very proud of, I think. And, you know, the fact that it went worldwide and went global and it gave people a laugh was just amazing. I mean, I loved the byline, which was, you know, on the movie poster, I think it was from memory, they had absolutely nothing, but they were willing to risk it all. That kind of summed it up, you know?
Yeah. Well, look, that's brilliantly described and clearly a family favourite, which is great. And in the 2+ years I've been doing this show, no one's chosen it. So that's great.
Yeah. Well, that's either a sign that it's not up to scratch. I mean, maybe it's not highbrow enough or whatever, but I always go for what the common man and woman would like to see, you know. And
come. And it stood you in good stead. Come here, away from that for a second. There's a couple of radio questions I want to ask you that you're probably asked all the time, but bear with me. You mentioned being, you know, a kid, you want to be a football player or a rock and roll star. Yeah. Did you always want to be a DJ? That's the sense I have. You kind of fell in love with radio.
Yeah, I did. And I mean, like, I have on occasion gone into things in television. And I always find that a little bit too many people are depending on you in the whole thing. Radio is very intimate, and you've got a microphone, and you're kind of more in control of what you're doing. Not that I'm a control freak or anything like that, but you know what I mean? It's just that you're responsible for your own actions. Whereas if you've got a lighting person and a camera person and whatever, you know, so radio would be my first love, and it will be my last, I would imagine, you know. But it's, you know, and I did dream of that when I was like a 5-year-old, 6-year-old. I used to say, I want to be on the radio. So I was lucky that I was able to fulfill that. I'm sure there are lots of people working in other jobs that are not what they dreamt of doing, and and, you know, they weren't able to do it, but I was lucky. I mean, somebody said at one of my milestone birthdays and they shocked my whole family, who were also there, said, well, of course Ian was very lucky. And everybody said, oh, how dare you say that, you know, that, no, Ian is very talented, or Ian is very this, but when you think about it, I was very lucky, because I was there at the right time. Pirate radio was happening, there were lots of opportunities, and, you know, so from that point of view, I was able to live the dream, so to speak, John.
Yes, indeed. Now, but look, you're not that you're downplaying your TV, but for a lot of people, again, in my generation, not to age it, but the beatbox was essential weekend viewing. And I mean, I'm sure that was fun at the time, right? I mean, I remember you interviewing massive stars on that.
Yeah, and I mean, sometimes on Twitter and that, you see people putting up footage from the old beatboxes, and they're saying, here's Ian Dempsey talking to the Human League, and here's Ian Dempsey talking to Howard Jones or Nick Kershaw, and you're saying, I don't remember doing any of that at all. You know, it all became a bit of a haze, to be honest with you. You know, and but yeah, it was great. And I mean, I remember we did a whole I remember a Boyzone special where we tried to reenact the kind of Beatles on the roof of the RTE building and all this, and they were all up there and all the fans were down. You know, so we had great fun. And it's a pity that there aren't shows like that anymore. Not that I wouldn't be interested in being involved, but somebody younger doing it. That, you know, the idea of just somewhere for 2 hours that they come on and they play a load of videos and they have a bit of crack and they talk about music. And, you know, it doesn't happen anymore. We've become too slick and too kind of, we don't have enough of an attention span anymore, I don't think, you know, to sit down for 2 hours and actually just chill out. But there you go.
Too slick. I like it. Well, listen, you won't get any slickness here, right? But Mark Cagney did this slot a while ago. And at the end of the interview, I asked him his favorite people to interview. And he's a lovely guy, but he kind of moaned and went, "That's a silly question." And I've learned never to ask anyone that again, right? Because it's like asking a comedian, "What's your worst gig?" But I was wondering, was there ever an interview that you did where you were really surprised by how good it was, or maybe you were apprehensive about, like, it's easy to remember the bad ones, but was there ever one where you thought, "Wow, that was great. I wasn't expecting that."
Well, I remember, I did two absolute megastars. One of them was Madonna. I did her in London. And the way they worked it out with the kind of Ireland and Britain was that they gave different territories. They could decide whether they wanted to go TV, radio, newspaper or whatever. So we decided that we were going to do, in Ireland, they decided that they were going to do radio. So I was sent over and Dave Fanning was with me actually as well. So we were doing a radio interview with Madonna. So what happened was we had all these guys from the News of the World and all these newspapers, all the tabloids as they existed at the time. And they were saying, ask her about this, ask her about that, because the British guys, they had decided to do Jonathan Ross TV instead. Okay. So they had no way of getting in. So we were given all these questions. But I remember doing the interview. I remember she was absolutely brilliant. And I asked her something about the Clatter Ring, which was she was wearing on her one of her album covers. And so she got the Irish thing in there. I asked her about Sinead O'Connor tearing up the picture of the Pope, and she gave me a great answer, which ended up on the cover of USA Today newspaper. But I remember leaving that interview having said, "That was really good. That was fantastic. It's going to be great." And then my voice went completely. It was like as if there was a kind of a nervous thing. You just, when you were mentioning there, were you nervous about something? I was really nervous about it. And I must have been able to keep, the adrenaline kept me going for the interview, and then it was gone. So I had to broadcast from London the next day, and it sounded like I had gone on the absolute lash in London after the interview, and then I couldn't even speak. So there you go. And the other one was Bruce Springsteen in Berlin.
Oh, wow.
The road manager had told me, we had gone down to the venue where we were going to do the interview the day before, and the road manager said to me, "Now, you're not to approach the artist," all this kind of stuff. It was all very formal. So I said, "Okay, fair enough." So I arrived 15 minutes before the interview the next day. She wasn't there, this road manager, but Bruce was, and he was just standing there, and he came over to me and he says, "You the guys I'm supposed to be meeting for the interview?" And I said, "Yeah." So he grabbed two Budweisers out of the fridge and he says, "Come on out." So we went outside to the sunshine of Berlin, and we sat under a little sort of an umbrella, and we were drinking our Budweisers doing the interview, and then your woman arrives absolutely horrified. But Bruce was, he was an absolute gentleman, a lovely, and I find that actually with a lot of these big stars, it's the people around them, and I suppose they're paid to be pretty awful, you know, to get their, they're protecting them, I suppose. But when you actually get to the heart of the whole thing, the people are actually quite nice, and they just want to have a little chat.
Yeah, cracking cans with the boss in the Berlin sunshine. My goodness. Look, I could keep you all day with this kind of stuff, so I better let you go. But just before I do, I watched Living with Lucy with you and Mario.
Oh, yeah.
And I just, you know, I'm in radio as well. I know what it's like, you know, relationships with people you're around all the day. It came across great. And I'm wondering the reaction you got. Because, you know, I may be wrong here, but you and he, it's probably, you know, a very important creative relationship you've had for the last 20 odd years in radio. Like, it's fair to say, you guys, I'm sure there's battles, you know, arguments, you know, the way it is, creative stuff, but you clearly are terribly fond of each other.
Yeah. And I mean, he sometimes describes me as his radio wife, and I don't know why I'm the wife and he's the husband.
Let's not get into that.
That could be. And we don't actually, argue that much at all, to be honest with you. We both, like, we can both say something, make a suggestion, and the other person can say, well, I don't agree with you on that one, and we just discuss it from a creative point of view. So we've had about two major rows, and they have been about stupid little things, very much like a husband and wife, I suppose. it is very good. And I mean, I couldn't believe the reaction I got to Lodging with Lucy, myself and Mario, and indeed Lucy, because Lucy was a great catalyst. And I remember in the middle of the thing, we worked out, and I'm not into zodiac signs or anything like that, but I remember we worked out at one stage during it that Mario, I think, is Virgo, I'm Capricorn, and she's Taurus. And those three are supposed to get on really well together. And we just realized it in the middle of the filming. And everybody said, that's why this is going so well. So we loved it. But the amount of people that have come up to me since in supermarkets or whatever and said, I really loved you on Lodging with Lucy. And of course, we recorded that, and they must have recorded about like 8 or 9 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they put it into 40 minutes or something. And I was shitting myself. I said, what the hell? What's going to come out of this? But I was quite happy with it. It worked out. You know?
Brilliant. Well, wait, you see how I edit this.
Exactly.
His favorite movie is The Commitments. I will age him for the last time by calling him a broadcasting legend. Thank you very much.
Thanks, John. Brilliant.
You're trying to tell me you play with B.B. King?
Among others, brother.
Like?
Have we got all day? Screaming Jay Hawkins, Martha Reeves, Sam Cooke, poor Sam, Otis Redding, may the Lord of Mercy on his sweet soul, Joe Tex, the Four Tops, Stevie Wonder, he was only 11, a pup, Wilson Pickett.
What are you doing in Dublin?
I'm tired of the road. My mammy isn't very well.
Why would you want to join us?
The Lord sent me. The Lord blows my trumpet.
Ah, yes, a clip there from The Commitments, as chosen by Ian Dempsey as his favourite movie. And my thanks to Ian, who is as nice a guy as you would imagine. And we realise, of course, that Commitments is now 30 years old, but he didn't choose it for anything to do with that. It's just his favourite movie, which he rewatched in lockdown. It is a wonderful film. And of course, I should mention that that was the now sadly departed actor Johnny Murphy you heard there playing Joey the Lips in The Commitments. That is it for this week. My thanks to Anne-Marie Kane, who helped out on the show. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on newstalk.com or the Newstalk app powered by Go Loud. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. right here on Newstalk. I'm open all week long on Twitter, John_Fardy, or you can email me, screentime@newstalk.com. That is it for this week. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. Have a good week, and we shall talk next week.